Welcome to Distilled, a podcast where we unpack the key issues facing us with some of the most original thinkers from India and the world. I'm Praveen Swami, and I'm speaking today with Maya Tudor, professor at the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University. Dr. Tudor is a leading scholar of nations and nationalism. Her research explores why some states in the developing world are stable, democratic, and effective, and why others aren't. For years now, I've been hearing people say that they want India to be a great country. This is, well, great, except it isn't always clear what a great country actually is. Lots of people thought Nazi Germany was great, or Imperial Britain or Belgium were great, despite the huge catalogue of horrors those countries created. Some people think North European social democracies are great, and others think that the Caribbean, with its beautiful beaches, is even greater. So what is a great country? Is it a rich country? A country with a lot of military power? A country with excellent education and social welfare?
So I would think about it in the following way. I think that nations are the biggest, the most capacious community that humans belong to. For much of human history, people interacted in face-to-face interactions in small communities that the people that they knew almost all the time. We've now reversed that. And now people, because most of the world now lives, or more of the world rather, lives in urban areas and in rural areas. And nations came around after Treaty of Westphalia as a way, as the basis of the new global political order. And they're one such community through which individuals get a sense of dignity, of respect, of recognition, right? We all have communities. We all, as I said, we're members of families and of neighborhoods, and those communities give our lives meaning. And for most people, especially non-elites, communities of nation also give them meaning, their lives in a sense meaning. So to return to your question, the greatness of, or the search for greatness through states is really just an individual cry for recognition.
So Dr. Tudor argues, when people talk about wanting a great nation, what they often mean is that they want to live in a country where their lives have dignity and meaning. The states which provide this, she calls effective states.
Effective states that are states that work for all of their citizens, not just a minority of citizens. It's states that provide kind of Maslowian basic set of goods. It provides peace and security. It provides basic access to education and health. And this is particularly important in the kind of context of modern politics, it provides some sort of social safety net. And this is also why nationalism matters in part, because nationalisms bind us together in this community of solidarity. You know, some person gets cancer and some person loses their job, and you think there, but for the grace of God, go I. And it's because that could be you, that person could be you, that you yourself think, well, it's important as a nation that we provide for one another. So, in fact, you saw many of the key welfare programs emerge in Europe, like the National Health Service and then the United Kingdom. Those emerged in the aftermath of World War II when there was a great degree of solidarity. So effective states provide those kind of basic goods, and nationalism is kind of, as Margaret Canavan said, a battery that powers policies.
Okay, so nationalism provides the sense of collective solidarity that enables us to care for each other, a kind of family or tribe in times where families and tribes are vanishing. But this isn't what a lot of nationalist movements are actually doing. For example, Donald Trump has cut Social Security and inequality has increased in America. Ditto right-wing governments across Europe. How come, I asked Dr. Tudor, nationalist movements seem to be doing the opposite of what they say they stand for?
Great question. I mean, I think of many of these new majoritarian nativist nationalist movements as movements that are effectively doing a bait and switch. They're not focusing on nationalism as a way of distracting. It's a way of distracting individuals from questions of bread and butter. And it's a substitution for it. So when we think of India, you know, Modi ran very clearly in 2014 on two platforms. One was economic development, and that was the first platform, and that was the one that was given the more prominent platform. The second platform was Hindu nationalism, right? There were these billboards in Mumbai that said, I'm a Hindu, I'm a nationalist. But actually, at least in my kind of anecdotal research, the students that I spoke to that voted for Modi, they said to me, you know, I don't really buy that Hindu nationalism stuff, but look, he's a man who's going to get something done. Well, you fast forward to 2019, and Modi hasn't delivered on economic development. You know, again, here the numbers are held back and they're a little bit shady. But I think we can very clearly say that the economy is not better. And by some indications, it's worse. And so it's not a surprise that under these circumstances, what Modi has done is substituted the second platform, that is Hindu nationalism, and elevate it to become the kind of primary platform on which he ran the last election, and very successfully so.
Lots of commentators were puzzled after the last general elections over why Prime Minister Modi wasn't hit by issues like unemployment or a slowing economy. One answer that we heard again and again from ordinary people was that the Prime Minister had given them a sense of dignity, even though their personal circumstances hadn't changed or even got worse.
As I said, it's not just Modi, it's also Trump, it's also the forces behind Brexit, it's also the forces behind Le Pen and Erdogan. They have recognized this need for dignity and a need for and respect. It takes a slightly different form in India because, unlike in India, it's not working classes who benefited from industrialization being left behind, but much more I think a desire among, you know, the many millions of Indians who have no connection to kind of India's founding national narrative, who think we want to see India become China. We want India to assume an assertive place on the global stage. And Modi is giving them that.
One reason for the rise of nationalist movements, Dr. Tudor argues, is that liberals and progressives just haven't understood the depth of concern that nationalist movements are speaking to.
Leftist, liberals, progressives have got to think very hard about their culpability here in a sense of threat that is very prominent. You mentioned the United States, at least in the United States and Europe. I think it's slightly different in India, and we can talk about that if you're interested. But a sense of threat that is born of a globalization that has left them behind, a shrinking social welfare system that has not provided for basic needs, and frankly, a certain kind of cultural elitism that looks down upon many of the identities of nation, of frankly religion, that are important to people. When that fear is invoked, when it's elevated, it's much more likely, I think, to lead to these kind of us versus them dynamics.
It makes sense that people would turn to nationalist movements because they're fearful. Everything they take for granted appears to be crumbling, the future bleak and uncertain, so we seek to secure ourselves through collective solidarity. But why is it, I asked Dr. Tudor, that nationalism also leads us to turn against others, sometimes in very violent and ugly ways, as we see in so many parts of the world? The most interesting answers to this question, she told me, are coming from evolutionary biologists who study our primate relatives.
So Robert Zapolsky, who's at Stanford and a famous evolutionary biologist, wrote a piece in the, I think it was March-April issue of Foreign Affairs, in which she said that, you know, we humans are closely related to chimps. Chimps kill outsider chimps. And so aggression towards non-members of our group, non-members, is something that's biologically
built into our identity. Now, I actually think that research, I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but I've spent some time last year at Stanford with an evolutionary biologist who's working with Jane Goodall's data. Her name is Elizabeth Lonsdorf. And some of her work and some of her collaborators' work are showing that actually we're just as closely related to bonobo monkeys as we are to chimps. Bonobo monkeys don't kill outsider monkeys. They welcome them. Why the difference? So human societies, human nature is not fixed. We can imagine worlds in which we're welcoming of outsiders. And here's the critical part, though. Circumstances of threat sharpen, heighten us versus them environment. This is why I said I think it's important not to shrink from nationalism, but to engage in the debate over what does it mean to be an Indian. And I think India, unlike other countries, has a very rich history from which it can say to be Indian means to be inclusive.
But why bother, you could ask? Why should we be inclusive? Why shouldn't we look after just those who we think are our own?
Sure, but my argument and my research is showing that it's that those countries, in fact, the norm historically is not to be inclusive across the key cleavages of race, religion, and ethnicity. But where you are inclusive or exclusive in democracy is more likely to break down.